Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Crippled King by A. Trey McMacken, narrated by Peter Noble. 1. The Claim. It had been 17 years, by his reckoning, since he climbed the winding stone to the surface and squinted into the bright light of the sun. He had seen only a handful of souls since then, a few other lone prospectors as bedraggled as he, and a trade caravan to which he sold a lump of copper in exchange for a new shirt. The last time he had seen anyone was 2 summers ago. The old dwarf had worn a white beard down to his knees, matted with years of detritus, and gathered irregularly by thick bands of dried rabbit leather. His clothes hung loose and frayed over an emaciated frame. His pack seemed bigger than his own torso. The two had looked at each other for a moment.
"Uglan fer Belkarak," the old prospector had guttered.
It meant, "The claim is mine." No other words were exchanged. Nain continued on his way. One day, he reckoned, he would look no different, if he survived that long, if no tunnel collapsed on him, no disease struck, no bear attacked. What was 1 year from the next? What had happened in his 8th year on the surface? Nain could not recall. Maybe that old prospector was already dead, his bones bleached in the sun. That was the final shame of the unwanted, the ultimate end of the tan that dried Nain's skin like leather. After meeting the old dwarf, Nain moved further into the wilds of the northwest, hoping to avoid any more such encounters. He did not know it, but he had not spoken in 3 years, and then only to a crow that had landed on a rock near his foot. A simple greeting, as was polite. The land was jagged and difficult, cut by deep rushing rivers and unstable rock screes. These were the Kara Indal, the North Mountains. The massive snow-capped peaks jutted over the northern skyline, some reaching 10,000 feet. The range stretched east and west beyond sight. Great folds of bedrock bent and twisted through the landscape, revealing layers of limestone, sandstone, and shale, with intrusions of dark igneous rock piercing like spears. Nain perched atop a ridgeline, scanning the countryside to the northwest. 2 rocky arms of a tall mountain stretched south in parallel, forming a wide depression between them. Conifers filled the gap and blanketed the sides of the arm-like ridges, thinning higher up and leaving the ridge crests bare. Glaciers nestled on the mountain's shoulders as if the mountain wore a great mantle of ice. Wavering glints of sunlight reflected from the slopes, hinting at flowing water. To his eye, there appeared to be a break in the trees near the far end of the valley. Either there had been a wide rock slide, or maybe there was a lake. Even from that distance, Nain could see a fold of rock on the western arm near the mountain's base, beyond the opening in the trees. Such landscapes, with the action of glaciers and water, promised opportunities for exposed veins. But they also posed risks. These high mountain valleys harbored bears, moose, and wolves, all of which could spell an easy death for an unwary lone dwarf. He did not worry over the darker tales. In his 17 years, he had seen no sign of such horrors. Still, Nain had never come so close to the foot of such a great mountain, never driven so far in from the foothills. Despite the danger, risk promised reward, whether or not it told the truth. Nain knew, as all dwarves did, that these folds of rock were the result of the great cataclysm that raised up the mountains and beat down the valleys, and that the same cataclysm formed the gems and crystals and ores that they sought. So Nain scouted along the seams, hoping to find hints of indicator minerals. Lead, zinc, nickel, chrysoberyl, garnet, anything that might lead to a vein of silver, or gold, or even iron. Iron was necessary. Every few years, Nain would need to forge new picks and hammers. If Nain found hopeful signs of indicator minerals, he may drive a shaft for some distance, hoping to strike a vein within a reasonable time. Else he moved on. Nain shouldered his pack again. It weighed nearly as much as he, but dwarf shoulders were broad and strong. And after these 17 years, Nain didn't notice the weight. He eyed the rocky descent below, chose a path that looked stable, and began to pick his way down. By nightfall, he reached the valley floor. He lodged himself in a crevasse between two boulders and jammed his pack into the entrance. A storm blew over in the dark, a strong wind whipping the treetops back and forth. The wind was powerful, battering the landscape. He heard the snapping and fall of limbs, and the crack of thunder. But in his rock crevasse, he fell asleep. Not even the rain disturbed him, long used to the weather of the mountains. He was alone in the night, alone in the world. The scattered signs left by other prospectors had faded over the past few years of his westward drift. And this summer, he had not seen any hint of other dwarves, past or present. With hundreds and thousands of square miles of wilderness, that was hardly surprising. Dwarves did not love those mountains, the Kara Indal. It was said that they harbored creatures of ill and fell nature. It may have been centuries since the last wars, but they remembered. Dwarves always remembered. They wrote it in stone, and they whispered it in the dark to their children. It took half the next day to reach the upper valley along the far arm of the mountain, where he had seen the fold of rock in the distance. He picked his way for an hour or more between the dead trunks of toppled spruce trees, their sharp, broken branches scraping his skin. At some point, an avalanche had dislodged them from the ridge above, along with heaps of gravel. The smell of pine tar was thick in the fresh mountain air. Eventually, the ridge rose to a sheer cliff face, 75 yards in height, before it broke away into a rugged, sloping ascent. Nain followed the foot of the cliff where the spruce grew tall, some rising above the crest of the cliff above. That's when something in the pine needles caused him to halt. The woods here were relatively open. Conifer needles and ferns made up the soft forest floor, and the trees had long ago shed their shadowed lower branches in the search for daylight high above. In front of Nain, ferns had been trampled, and pine needles turned up to reveal black, moist soil beneath. A nearby spruce showed long, deep gouges in the bark, with sticky resin and sap leaking down its trunk and leaving a blackened stain. Nain walked a few steps forward and crouched at a large pile of scat. It still glistened with moisture, and it appeared to be full of dead ant carcasses. It was fresh. Nain glanced around and tried to figure out what way the creature had gone. It could only be one of two directions, ahead or eastward to his right. To the west rose the cliff face, and he had come from the south. He pulled on his beard unconsciously, feeling the skin on his chin and face prickle at the tug. He wore his beard long, unruly and free, tucked into the top of his shirt to keep it out of the way. So far as Nain could tell, the ferns and needles were undisturbed along the base of the cliff ahead of him. The rock face may have blocked his movement, but it also guarded his side, and the strength of the sandstone comforted him. He reached back and slipped the haft of his pick through a leather knot. He stood and walked on, pick in hand. Nain could see the footslope of the mountain ahead. The ground grew firmer beneath his feet as the loam thinned. A brightness in the trees up ahead bespoke a clearing. Another 100 yards and he saw the glimmer of light reflected off water. The spruce grew right up to the edge of the clear mountain lake, with only a narrow shingle of cobbles. Nain knew it was deceptively deep, even though he could see the bottom, until the angles showed only the reflection of sky and mountain. To the east of the lake, wetlands and meadows with tangled streams stretched away so that he could not see their extent. The wetlands were interspersed with skeletal pine saplings and waving green reeds. Two elk stood near the eastern shore, hock deep in water, partially concealed by scrub. They took no note of him. To the north, a stony stream ran into the lake, and beyond it, he could trace the path of the water from high up the mountainside, where falls showed white and motionless in the distance. Only a long, narrow strip of land, with a lone stand of cedar clinging bravely to rock and moss, separated the lake from the cliff face to the west. There was what Nain sought. He tasted the saliva as his mouth watered. Still, he felt the same old excitement. In the rock, two great sweeps of layered stone curled and diverged, as if during the cataclysm, land had been rolled up on each end like a mat and pushed together, unfurling in opposite directions in great curves. Veins of igneous rock stabbed up through the exposed layers. Here had been great movement and great pressure. All the tons of rock pressed against each other, smashed and roiling as the world moved. Something had torn away the mountain here, leaving the sheer cliff. Nain had seen such sheer mountain faces near glacier-fed lakes before. It was a promising spot, and Nain's heart beat. There was no telling what he may find within that ancient seam. Nain hurried along the shingle between cliff and water. He would delve right at the base of the diverging layers of rock, where the forces of the cataclysm had created the most pressure and heat. He couldn't see it yet. The spot was hidden from his sight by the stand of cedar near the northern edge of the lake, beyond which the land began its rapid ascent to the mountain slopes above. A small peninsula jutted out into the lake near the cedars. Nain pushed his pace to a jog, his pack jostling him as he held the straps with both hands. He ducked in among the cedars, turned, and caught his breath. There was a gap in the rock, just wide enough for a dwarf to enter sideways. Its frame made with even, skillful strokes, and smoothed out with care. It was an adit, a mine entrance. Up to it led a well-trodden path of stone chips. Nain stared, the hairs on his arms prickling. So it was already claimed. Here, far beyond the last sign of dwarven activity he had seen, huddled under a grand, wild mountain. Here was a claim. Nain stepped back. Now that he knew what he looked for, he saw that the peninsula that jutted out beyond the cedars was artificial, made by the dumping of overburden and tailings from the mine into the lake. Nain gripped the straps of his pack. He would run before he was seen. There would be no friendly welcome. He could climb north into the trees, then across the arm of the mountain, and further west. Something spluttered. He crouched down beside a cedar trunk, hoping he hadn't been seen. Again, a sound like a whimper or a gurgle, followed by rustling. It came from the northern edge of the trees. He peered around the trunk. The snapped crown of a cedar lay on the stones about 5 yards away, its tip in the water of the lake. It must have broken off during the storm last night. Its needles still looked fresh and green. The broken treetop rustled again. Sticking out from under the needles of the fallen tree was a leg. For some time, Nain didn't move. He felt his heart beating all through his body. The leg twitched, but there was no more noise. He looked back at the entrance to the claim. No movement. No sign of anyone else. Hunched over, he crept toward the tree. He could see the brown cloth of the pant leg, stained with years of stone dust, but neatly mended. A moment's hesitation, and then he reached out and parted the branches. Pinned face down beneath the fallen trunk was a dwarf. The trunk crossed the stranger's back above both arms and pinned him against the rocks. Nain couldn't see his face because the dwarf wore a hood. He stared for a moment, unsure if the stranger was even alive. But then he saw the movement of breath. Faint, but sure. The poor fool must have come out during the storm for some reason. A snapped cedar, and now this. Just one more of the 1,000 ways the wilderness could kill you. The treetop was big, but Nain supposed he could have twisted, struggled, and rolled it away, especially if his life depended on it. But then the weight of the impact. He looked back at the entrance to the claim, a dark cleft in the face of the rock. Few prospectors ever joined forces. It was hard enough to strike it rich alone without having to spread the wealth. No, this claim belonged to the poor fool alone. Nain slowly released the branches of the tree, letting them return to place with as little sound as possible. He looked at the mine entrance again. Someone would do it to him if they had the chance. All prospectors slept uneasy when they worked a claim. And no one expected mercy in the wilderness. In these mountains, there were no tongues to tell. The stranger had probably hidden his finds somewhere close, or maybe just stored them inside. After all, who could expect to be found so far into this wasteland? It would be easy. Nain wouldn't even have to do anything, really. There was a clatter of loose rock along the shingle. He looked up across the treetop and along the shore. 100 yards away was a bear. It stood on its hind legs, head erect, snuffling at the air and looking toward the fallen tree. Down the left side of its face and continuing past its shoulder was a white stripe of fur. It held its forearms out in front of it, each paw the size of Nain's head. And it strained to see what might be on the other side of the tree. He made eye contact, stupid. The bear dropped to all fours, took one powerful lunge forward, and roared, twisting its head side to side. It felt like the sound passed through Nain's body. Saliva shone on the bear's fangs. He straightened his arms and let his pack fall to the ground. Then grabbed two branches of the tree and pushed hard with his whole body. The tree gave way, rolling forward on its far branches and lifting the trunk a few inches. He pushed in with his shoulder and reached down, taking hold of one of the dwarf's arms. It was awkward, but Nain was strong. He dragged the dwarf behind him across the rocks. He could hear the grunting growl and clatter of stones getting closer. His grip squeezed the stranger's arm as he leaned to run and pull at once. He reached the path of loose rock, and the body slid easier. He expected to feel the impact of the bear in the last feet before the entrance. He could hear the beast's breaths lunge after him. In a fluid motion, he twisted and ducked, hauling hard and hoping the body did not get stuck. And he was through. He heard a loud, gravelly exhale from behind, then more snuffling. He dragged hard at the stranger as his eyes adjusted to the dark, and he hoped the mineshaft wasn't booby-trapped. They were inside the adit, at least farther than the bear could reach. Nain turned. The beast glowered in through the small opening, far smaller than it could hope to fit through. It stuck its snout in the adit, and its hot breath puffed and sucked in the scent of dwarves. Nain could smell its breath, its fur, like snow and clover and blood. With a disgruntled moan, the bear turned and shambled out of sight, heading south. Ugh, it smelled like piss. Nain looked down at the body of the dwarf, disgusted. He'd have time to wonder why he'd done that later. For now, his first horrified thought was that the bear had torn off the stranger's leg. For there was only one leg. Then he saw that there was something where the upper leg should be, tightly wrapped in thick felt. Then, with even more horror, Nain saw the dwarf's face. It was a dwarf wife, an old, old dwarf woman. Maybe one in three dwarves born is born a girl. They're the prized jewels of their families, closely guarded. Some of the greatest female smiths and artisans of the highest tiers never marry, choosing instead to train a woman of talent to take over their forge. A dwarf maid who did marry brought a great wealth to her family in the form of a bride price, which is why only the eldest son typically married, unless the family couldn't afford even that, which was also common enough. A dwarf maid from a higher caste family demanded a weighty price, and some families chose extinction rather than pay a dowry for a goatherd dwarf maid. Still, it was much easier for a maid to move up castes. Nain's parents would have preferred it if he had been a girl, he knew. A girl would have brought wealth to the family. A third son was in line to inherit neither his father's occupation nor his mother's. Not that there was much to inherit from his parents. But two boys and then a girl was a fortune worth celebrating, two inheritances and a bride price. A third son was only worth the price of cheap labor. Some dwarf wifes even had 9 or 10 children in their 60 or 70 childbearing years. A few lucky families had 2, even 3 girls, each a prize. But the extra sons would labor for the elders, with little hope for more. If it had been wartime, there would have been fighting, and along with it, dying, and the opportunity to fill the gaps. But there had not been war in 21 decades. And now even war, or practicing war, was a hereditary occupation. All of this is why Nain gaped down into the face of the old dwarf crone, his jaw slightly open. Women did not go prospecting. Women did not leave their colonies. Women were not found pinned under a tree in the northwest wilderness of the Kara Indals. The old dwarf wife's face was covered in so many wrinkles that they appeared to be layered. She had lived a long, hard life. Nain guessed she must be at least 250 years old, or older. Her thick clothes were worn but well mended, the grey of felted, undyed mountain goat wool. The tunnel continued some yards into the mountain, straight and smooth, perfectly arched at the top, just wide and high enough for a dwarf to walk and carry tools. His sightline down the tunnel was interrupted by a flight of stairs upwards. Sensible, Nain would have done the same in case the lake should flood. No doubt there was a narrow ventilation shaft drilled somewhere higher in the cliff face. Nain had a good view of the adit, as daylight still entered through the opening. With his back to the light, he could examine the floor, walls, and back of the mine. The sandstone was smooth here, with no gravel or shale. So far as he could tell, there were no traps. But a clever dwarf could conceal a trap, and this one must have been clever to survive so long. And yet, felled by a tree. Sorry, bastard. Nain stopped himself swearing, even in his mind. It was a dwarf whiff. Nain knelt down next to the woman. She was still breathing. He could see the shallow rise and fall of breaths. The woman's eyes startled open, and he lurched back.
Uglan fair Belkarak, she rasped.
The claim is mine. Her eyes closed again. Nain slipped his arms beneath her and lifted, grunting. He had to walk sideways down the tunnel to carry her through. It was 10 yards to the steps. He gazed up, hoping there was nothing hidden there. No false steps that led to a death drop, or a trigger for a rock fall from above. No, not this far into the wilderness. 7 steps and he reached the landing. The tunnel was no wider here, driving forward into the mountain beyond his sight. But to his right was a carven door fit perfectly into the tunnel wall. There was no latch, so he put his shoulder against it and pushed. It opened easily. More than enough light for Nain's dwarven eyes reflected up the steps and into that room. It was a living chamber, its ceiling composed of 4 smooth triangular cuts into the mountain, joining in a peak 10 feet up. It was deftly fitted with smooth cedar log braces. All around the chamber were shelves and the odds and ends of living. More than most prospector claims boasted, there was even a fireplace with a hearth in the eastern wall. A bed jutted from one side of the room, covered in elk pelt. Nain laid the old woman down there and took a better look around. A tool rack with 2 mattocks and an assortment of hammers, chisels, and saws dominated one wall. Nain walked over to it and ran his finger along the iron. Well forged. Better than his own, at least. A table abutted the rack, and on it was a pitcher, a cup, and a bowl, all of fired clay. A cask of split cedar with a stopper in it stood on one end of the table. He walked over and looked into the pitcher and scented honey. He poured some into the cup and drank it off. Mead. She was making mead. He filled again and carried the cup to the old woman, lifting her up and putting it to her lips. He tilted the cup until the amber liquid wet her bottom lip. She flinched. He tilted more, and she swallowed, then turned her head away. He lay her back again, sad and awkward. He sighed. He was no healer, nor did he want to be. There was another door on the far side of the room. He walked over and opened it to reveal another set of narrow stairs beyond. He closed it again. There was a lot to see, but first things first. He had left his pack outside, and in his hurry to reach the fold in the ridge, he had not eaten that day. Food was one of the most irritating parts of prospecting. Hungry for ore and gem, he could easily forget to eat. But then his strength would fail him. Every few days he was forced to forage or to snare game or fish, and smoke or dry it. It cut in half the distance he could travel due to the time spent. Nain opened a cupboard that stood in a corner. Here, at least, was food. Dried meat in strips hanging over pegs. Bowls of nuts. He saw cave bread, made of a dry, crumbly fungus that grew up cave walls, and when pounded and sieved could be baked into a flat, earthy bread. He took a strip of meat and bit into it. It was good, and salted. She had salt. Salt meant a salt spring somewhere. Certainly she did not carry enough salt here on her back to preserve meat. He turned and looked back at the old woman. Her eyes were open, and she was watching him. Nain set down the meat, left the cupboard open, wiped his hand on his dirty shirt and walked back to the bed. He offered her another drink.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?